Blog Talk Radio. Greetings, this is Abayomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine. It's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Today is Thursday, August the 29th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal. Later on, we'll be coming up with our regular Pan-African Newswire reports. We'll have some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day. These will include the Israeli occupation forces invasion of the West Bank. Students are set to resume demonstrations in solidarity with Palestine in the United States. China-Africa trade has reached 1.7 trillion won, and Nigeria has received its first shipment of the mpox vaccine. In the second and third hours, we continue our commemoration of Black August, the historical legacy of struggle by African people against enslavement, colonialism, neocolonialism, and imperialism, and all forms of exploitation and oppression. We'll have a reexamination of events, some aspects of the events of 1971. These and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. Stay tuned. We'll take our musical interlude with the Funko and the TPOK Jazz Orchestra. Let's listen in.
Thank you. Yeah. motongo
Taimwana sala na sambwa
Olangwa kila munu lelo komi kizo disae
Taimwana suta na bebyo
Ninyite ya nzoto mama oti yango wapie shirie
Taimwana sala na sambwa
Halo baba boti nanga inganga lelo yona moni Tongo mama,
Taimwana sala na sambwa.
Olangwa kila munu lelo komi kizo disae.
Taimwana suta na bebyo.
Ninyite ya nzoto mama, oti yango wapie mwanama.
Taimwana sala na sambwa.
Malo baba boti nanga inganga lelo yona moni.
Taimwana suta na bebyo. Na motemba soka bolingo ya lokumu.
Thank you. Let's go.
Yeah.
Welcome back, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio Broadcast, this special edition of our program. You just heard the music of the TPOK Jazz Orchestra, led by Francois Luambo, better known as Franco, music from the mid-1980s. And right now we want to move into our Pan-African Newswire segment. These are some of the headlines in today's Pan-African Newswire. Palestinian resistance factions vow that the Israeli assassination of the commander of the Al-Quds Brigades, Tarkam Brigade, will only strengthen the resistance in the West Bank. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement confirmed earlier today that Mohammed Jabbar, known as Abu Shuja, the commander of the Al-Quds Brigade, the Tarkam Brigade, was killed along with several other resistance fighters following confrontations with Israeli occupation forces in the Tarkam refugee camp in the northern West Bank. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad highlighted in a statement the role of Abu Shuja, one of the founding members of the Tarkam Brigade, stating that, quote, the Palestinian people knew him for his steadfastness and bravery, unquote. The movement said that Abu Shuja was known as, quote, a resistance fighter who chose to confront the occupation to lift the oppression off his people, fully aware that facing the occupation, regardless of the cost, is far better than living under its rule, unquote. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad indicated that the Israeli occupation mobilized dozens of soldiers along with armored vehicles and drones to reach Abu Shuja in the heart of the Tarkam camp, because it was aware that the commander and his comrades would not surrender and would engage in heroic confrontations against them. And in other news, in Palestine, Israeli occupation forces have launched an aggression expected to be the largest in 22 years on several governments in the occupied West Bank. This began late on Tuesday night. China on Thursday expressed concern over the escalating violence in the West Bank, with Foreign Minister spokesperson Lin Jian stating, quote, we are deeply concerned about the escalation in the West Bank. China opposes actions that fuel tensions and condemns all attacks on civilians, unquote. Jian urged all parties, particularly Israel, to remain calm and exercise restraint and prevent further escalation and deterioration of the situation, adding that China is closely monitoring the ongoing war. Israeli occupation forces launched an aggression which is expected to be the largest in 22 years. The European Union foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, denounced the Israeli foreign minister's proposal to displace people from the West Bank as, quote, completely unacceptable, unquote. Israel Maariv news website reported that the Israeli occupation's foreign minister, Israel Katz, proclaims that the threat in the West Bank should be addressed similarly to Gaza. After making the comparison, Katz noted that Israel is seeking the temporary evacuation of the residents in the Jenin and Tarkam camps, which, following his comparison to the genocide in the Strip, would translate to widespread massacres, given the intentions to eliminate what he referred to as the terrorist infrastructure within the camps. You are listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. China's trade with Africa grew steadily in the first 7 months of the year, rising 5.5% year on year to 1.19 trillion won, about 166.6 billion U.S. dollars, according to data released by the General Administration of Customs. China-Africa trade reached a record high of 281.1 billion U.S. dollars in 2023, up 1.5%. year-on-year, showing strong resilience. In 2023, China's imports of African nuts, vegetables, flowers, and fruits increased by 130%, 32%, 14%, and 7%, respectively, from the previous year. And finally, in the West African state of Nigeria, the country has become the first one on the African continent to obtain mpox vaccines. It received 10,000 doses of the vaccine from the United States of America. Nigerian authorities have reportedly prioritized five states, Bayelsa, Edo, Cross River, Lagos, and Rivers, with the highest burden of Mpox cases. Mpox cases have been confirmed in more than 10 of Nigeria's 36 states. The ceremonial signing of Abuja on August the 27th came 1 week after the World Health Organization declared a global health emergency. Today's handover ceremony symbolizes more than a transfer of vaccines. It exemplifies the power of international cooperation in addressing global health challenges and local health challenges. That's according to Dr. Muyi Aina, Executive Director and Central and CEO of the National Primary Healthcare Development Agency. We're aware that this vaccine is not exactly in surplus supply. I believe we are getting 10,000 of about 200,000 doses that are available globally. The United States government has donated the Jynneos, the MVA vaccine, to Nigeria. Getting an Mpox vaccine can help prevent infection. It is recommended for people at high risk of getting Mpox. With that, though, we'll conclude our Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In concluding this segment of our program, we'd like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998. Since then, it has published tens of thousands of articles and dispatches in hundreds of newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, just go to our website, and that's at the panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. If you'd like to have access to today's Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast for Thursday, August the 29th, 2024, go to the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week.
Right now.
Of the new Rotary Connection from their album in 1971. That was Shirley Walls on lead vocals with the track entitled Song for Every Man. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast. We'll be continuing our Black August commemoration. In our last program, we reviewed the impact of the counterintelligence program against the Black Liberation Movement. Today, we want to listen to some audio files, rare archival audio files of first Huey P. Newton speaking on the New Haven trial, which was a big focus of the Black Panther Party after the release of Huey P. Newton in August of 1970. Let's listen to these audio files on the situation involving the New Haven trial that was taking place simultaneous to the release and, of course, later full-blown. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast for Thursday, August the 29th, 2024.
Yeah, because I was in the church 3 months. I didn't know what was happening. To me, it was like a great leap forward. When I came back outside to party with the brave before, we would just make a headway into the community. Now, any community we go into, people come out of their homes.
You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, special.
Okay. What are you
going to
do?
Okay,
Huey,
you have a statement to read? Make a statement.
I have something to say.
Nice and loud.
Okay, nice and loud.
Go ahead. I would like to call attention of a legal lynching that is about to take place in New Haven, and that is the legal lynching of McGlucus. McGlucus' jury will go out on Tuesday. We're calling for the community to come and give the judicial, the racist judicial system of this country and New Haven in particular, a mandate. And that mandate will be against this lynching that's about to take place. Only the power of the people can stop this. I know from experience that the people can transform society and can surely free political prisoners and prisoners of war. I'm asking the people to do what they have done. I'm asking the people to do for Maglucas what they have already done for me, and that is free Maglucas. We were informed by Maglucas that the district attorney has offered him a deal. Usually in a case serious as this one, the district attorney will not offer a deal. But he offers a deal in this case because, first, the state's case is fabricated against Maglucas. The state doesn't really want Maglucas. They want Bobby Seale, our chairman. They would like Erica Huggins. They also would like Landon. The deal was, Maglucas, if you testify against the chairman, Bobby Seale, if you testify against Erica Huggins and Landon, then we will mitigate your sentence and give you 15 to 20 years and guarantee that you will be out in 8 years. This is a statement of the district attorney. Maglucas, of course, refused this. He refused to testify or lie against anyone. The guilty party is George Sams, who's an agent for the FBI, and a madman. He's a very ill person. And I have very much sympathy for George Sams, matter of fact. He shouldn't be in prison. He should be in a therapeutic environment. I can't say he should be in a mental institution, not in this country, because this country is not equipped to deal with sick people, and because it's not even equipped to deal with well people. And this is why the Black Panther Party says it's necessary for the people to transform this society and therefore free the world in order for the world to be a place where human people can exist. Now, as for Maglucas, we would like to call you out at 10 o'clock on Tuesday. We're holding a rally there. And if you come out in the mass, then the courts will get the point that the people will no longer stand to see a member of our group, a member of the human race, be crucified without justice whatsoever.
Where's the rally, in New Haven or New York?
On the New Haven Green.
Is there any way, then, in your opinion, that Mr. Maglucas can get a trial, and get a fair trial?
The professor of Yale, the president, Brewster, stated that black revolutionary cannot get justice in an American court. I don't believe that that
your party, what effect has it had on the party itself?
It's made the party a very, it's motivated the party. We're highly motivated against the legal lynching that's about to take place. As far as crushing the party, it's impossible to crush the party because the party is one with the people. And in order to crush the party, that genocide will have to be inflicted not only upon the people of this country, but the people of the world, because we struggle with all oppressed people. We struggle against the international bourgeoisie, which is home here in North America. We realize that no oppressive government, no fascist government can exist unless the United States imperialistic government supports it. So we know that the final battle will occur here, and this will be the battle of liberation for the whole world.
You call for a community mandate. You say you want
to gather together to decide what action to take. This action might take the form of a political action or military action. In other words, that we believe in taking any action that's effective effective at the time.
What kind of military action could you take against the court?
We never broadcast our military maneuvers for military reasons. We might broadcast them for political reasons, which we've done in the past. This time, the game is a very serious one, and we're not willing to play it, matter of fact. That we're serious, and whatever we do, we'll do that, and we operate on the axiom that in order to say what I want to say, I can't do what I want to do. To do what I want to do, I can't say what I want to say. Therefore, observe our actions, and you'll know what I want to say.
Well, how do you characterize your organization?
Is the vanguard here in North America representing the We say that in the first place that we're colonized people. And even though we're colonized, not in a classical sense, because we're a colony brought home to the mother country, but we're colonized nevertheless. So we would say that the first that we're enslaved, and we are not willing to bargain for one slave master against the other. And we are not begging the slave master to be a little more kind. The only thing he can do is stop being a slave master. Everything else is only sort of an absurd action. In other words, his kindness is not appreciated.
Huey, would this,
if he ever displays any, which he doesn't.
Huey, would this military action be confined as the state of Connecticut, or would it be nationwide?
When the people decide to move, I'll guarantee you it will be international. The Black Panther Party is an international party. We have a coalition with all struggling people of the world. And we feel that we must be internationalists because we're fighting an international enemy.
How soon do you think the people are going to want to move?
The people are already moving. The people are moving in Vietnam. The people are moving in Laos. The people are moving in Cambodia. The people are moving in Latin America, Brazil. The people are moving everywhere. We're just joining in. Matter of fact, we're latecomers.
International communism has as one of its tenets the fact that it will try to win over people in other countries. Are you allying the Black Panther Party with that type of movement, in fact, perhaps that movement?
We support all people who struggle for national independence and self-determination. Some of these countries are revolutionary nationalists, and others choose to be socialists. That's their business. We say that they must be free because we realize as the countryside of the world becomes free, and we, the Black Panther Party, calls the developing countries of the world the countryside of the world, while the United States is a city of the world. And we realize that the United States thrives upon the raw materials of the countryside. As each country becomes free, that it chokes the city because the city needs the raw materials, you see. So as the city is choked, then this increases our chances here as a colonized people to become free. So while we're not nationalists, we support national wars of independence. We know that once the imperialist is crushed, nationalism will not be necessary any longer.
Do you support
because,
the Viet Cong?
Pardon me?
Do you support the Viet Cong?
Of course, we support the Vietnamese people. Matter of fact, pardon me?
Viet Cong.
Oh, the Vietnamese people don't know what the word means, and they never use the word, so I don't know what it means.
Huey, in what country would you say the people are free? What is an example of that?
Well, we're offering troops to the people who are engaged in armed struggle against the racist, reactionary American troops in Vietnam. We're now awaiting an answer. We've sent a formal declaration to the Provisional Revolutionary Government in the South. We've sent a declaration to the Paris Peace Talks, one to the National Liberation Front, and we're now waiting for a reply. We also sent a copy to our embassy in Algiers. We've been recognized. We celebrate with us because we've been recognized now as the official liberation revolutionary group in North America. We have an embassy in Algiers, and now we're ready to launch a new international, which will be called the New World Liberation Front.
Why are you holding press conference in Eastside Penthouse?
Pardon me?
Why do you hold press conferences in penthouses? Aren't they kind of diametrically opposed to what you're talking about?
No, because we thought we would come where you fellows live. You see?
Are you blaming the Nixon administration or Mr. Hoover's office for the situation that the Panthers are in now?
I'm blaming the first and foremost the 76 companies who control Nixon. These are the monopolies or the oligarchy that controls not only the people in this country, but also who runs the empire. Because remember, this is not a nation. It has no right to claim nationalism. It's an international country. Only the international bourgeoisie is in control. We want to transform this into an international socialistic government where the people will be in control. And then when America plans its economy, it will have to plan for the people of the world also, because I might rap to you, but I'm getting a headache now, okay?
One question.
Does this, what you said just now, for Tuesday, does this entail any basic change in the philosophy or political approach of the Black Panther Party?
No, we've always been nonviolent. We encourage nonviolence. But and that means that we never initiate violence, that we, just as the Vietnamese people, are using self-defense whenever we have to engage in a physical combat. But really, we have a motto within the party. It says that we're advocates of the abolition of war. We do not want war, but war can only be abolished through war. And in order to get rid of the gun, sometimes it becomes necessary to take up the gun.
Now,
you didn't turn the lights out, so I'm going to go. It's hot.
It was just a question. You said something about a slave master. I wanted to know how you define the slave master and whether or not Ms. Fonda and other people who have allied themselves or shown response to you are included in your definition of slave master.
Money is transformed into capital through the purchase of labor. So all those people who purchase labor in order to make a profit off of labor are capitalists and slave masters, no matter who they are.
That includes Jay
so
Fonda?
That not all white people are slave masters in your definition?
Pardon me?
Not all white people are slave masters.
Do all white people follow that principle that I just laid
Could
out?
Could you answer my question?
No, but you answered mine. I already answered yours.
No, all white people.
You answered your own question.
Thanks.
With regard to the situation with Mr. McLucas, if the district attorney did offer him a deal, is that not in fact an illegal act?
I would say it's illegal, but it's called plea bargaining. The courts are illegal. They let this kind of thing happen. They offer me a deal.
Set the light on.
You see?
The point I was making is every act is illegal on the part of the district attorney, I believe, on Marco. Then the action that you are talking about now is predicated upon an illegal act perpetrated by the system. Is that true or not?
Right. That's true. Right.
Huey, since you've been out of jail for a few short weeks, have you seen any major differences in the revolutionary movement in this country?
Matter of fact, the people about 70 years old or so came down and said, we didn't believe you, that we could ever see you in the flesh because you're too old to go to rallies. And we didn't believe you would ever be back down here because now you're television material. I informed them that the TV cameras didn't get me out of prison. They got me out with their support, you see. So we have a thing going with the community, and we're riding the high tide of history.
Welcome back, and that was Huey P. Newton speaking during August of 1970 on the New Haven trial, which Bobby Seale, Erica Huggins, and others were facing serious charges, even the death penalty. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, a worldwide radio broadcast. This is Black August. Today we're focusing on developments in 1970, and we'll get to 1971 a little bit later. Let's listen to another address by Huey P. Newton. This one is called We Demand Freedom.
2 centuries ago, when the United States was a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the conditions prevailed in the nation and the assumptions on which its foundation were built were such that they ensured that the United States would come to its maturity under circumstances, which mean that for a substantial proportion of citizens, life is nothing more than a living bed. Liberty is nothing more than a prison of poverty. And the only happiness we enjoy is laughing to keep from crying. We find evidence for majority freedom and minority oppression in the fact that even while the early settlers were proclaiming their freedom, they were deliberately and systematically depriving Africans of their freedom. These basic contradictions were further aggravated by acts which implicitly admitted that the majority was wrong, but unwilling to do right. Thus, when the Declaration of Independence was drafted, the Founding Fathers struck all mentions of the slave trade. Thus, when the United States Constitution was drafted, the Founding Fathers considered the slaves as equivalent to three-fifths of a man. Thus, when the slaves were emancipated, the descendants of the Founding Fathers compromised that freedom to gain further territory. These compromises were so basic to the thinking of the forebears that legal attempts to correct the contradiction through constitutional amendments and civil rights laws have produced no change in our conditions, and we are still a people without equal protection and due process of the law. We recognize then that the oppressive acts of the United States government, when contrasted with the testaments of freedom, carries forward a basic contradiction found in all the legal documents upon which this government is based. Generation after generation of the majority group have been born, they have worked, and they have seen the fruits of their labor in the life, liberty, and happiness of their children and grandchildren. Generation after generation of black people in America have been born, they have worked, and they have seen the fruits of their labors in the life, liberty, and happiness of the children and grandchildren of the oppressor. While their own descendants wallow in the mire of poverty and deprivation, holding only to the hope of change in the future. The hope has sustained us for many years and has led us to suffer the administration of a corrupt government. At the dawn of the 20th century, this hope led us to formulate a civil rights movement in the belief that the government would eventually fulfill its promise to black people. We did not recognize, however, that any attempts to complete the promise of the 18th century revolution in the framework of a 20th century government, economy, and society was doomed to failure. The descendants of that small company of original settlers of this land are not among the common people of today. They have become a small ruling class in control of a worldwide economic system. The Constitution set up by their ancestors to serve the people no longer serves the people. For the people have changed. The people of the 18th century have become the ruling circle of the 20th century. And the people of the 20th century are the descendants of the slaves and the dispossessed of the 18th century. The Constitution set up to serve the people of the 18th century now serves the ruling circle of the 20th century. And the people of today stand wanting for a foundation for their own life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. The civil rights movement has not produced this foundation, and it cannot produce this foundation because of the nature of the United States society and economy. The vision of the civil rights movement is to achieve goals which have been altered by 200 years of change. Thus, the civil rights movement and similar movements have produced no foundation for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. They have produced humiliating programs of welfare and unemployment compensation, programs with sufficient form to deceive the people, but with insufficient substance to change the fundamental distribution of power and resources in this country. Moreover, while the movements attempt to get minorities in the system, we note that the government continues its pattern of practice which contradicts its democratic rhetoric. We recognize now that we see history repeating itself, but on an international as well as a national scale. The relentless drive for profit led this nation to colonize, oppress, and exploit its minorities. This profit drive took this nation from democratic capitalism and underdevelopment to bureaucratic capitalism and overdevelopment. Now we see that this small ruling circle continues its profit drive by oppressing and exploiting the people of the world. Throughout the world, the proletariat is crushed so that the profits of the American industry can continue to flow. Throughout the world, the freedom struggle of oppressed people are opposed by this government because they are a threat to the bureaucratic capitalism of the United States of America. We gather here to let it be known at home and abroad that a nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness has in its maturity become an imperialistic power dedicated to death, oppression, and the pursuit of profit. We will not be deceived by so many of our fellow men. We will not be blinded by small changes in form which lack any change in substance of the imperialist expansion. Our suffering has been too long. Our sacrifices have been too great. And our human dignity is too strong for us to be prudent any longer. The Black Panther Party calls for freedom and power to determine our destiny. The Black Panther Party calls for full employment for all our people. The Black Panther Party calls for an end to the capitalistic exploitation of our community. The Black Panther Party calls for decent housing for all people. The Black Panther Party calls for an educational system that will tell us the true facts about this decadent society. The Black Panther Party calls for exemption from the military service. The Black Panther Party calls for an end to police brutality. The Black Panther Party calls for freedom for all political prisoners and prisoners of war. The Black Panther Party calls for trials by members of our peer when we're brought to the court and justice. The Black Panther Party calls for a United Nations plebiscite to determine the will of black people as to their national destiny. Black people and oppressed people in general have lost faith in leaders of America, in the government of America, and the very structure of the American government, that is the Constitution, its legal foundation. This loss of faith is based upon the overwhelming evidence that this government will not live according to the Constitution because the Constitution is not designed for its people. For this reason, we assemble a constitutional convention to consider rational and positive alternatives. Alternatives which will place the emphasis on the common man. Alternatives which will bring about a new economic system in which the rewards as well as the work will be equally shared by all people. A socialist framework. Alternatives which will guarantee that within the socialist framework, all groups will be adequately represented in decision-making and administration which affect their lives. Alternatives which would guarantee that all men will obtain their full manhood rights, that they will be able to live, be free, and seek out those goals which will give them respect and dignity while permitting the same privileges for every other man regardless of his condition or status. The sacredness of man and of the human spirit requires that human dignity and integrity ought to always be respected by every other man. We will sell for nothing less, or at this point in history, anything less is but a living death. It is a fact that we will get change. We will transform the society. It is up to the oppressor to decide whether this will be a peaceful thing or... We will use whatever means that is effective, regardless of the consequence, because it is our conclusion and our principle that a slave who dies a natural death will not balance two dead flies on the scales of eternity. We will have our manhood, even if we have to level the face of the earth. And I said again. So I would like to say that we are one tonight. Let us be one.
It was a man who went through the streets of the
black community of Oakland and says that a new state has begun, that the oppressed people of that community would no longer tolerate the rule of the dog who ran over our entire community, murdering our people and brutalizing our people. And he did this by himself at first, and then along with the chairman of our party, Bobby Seale, and also along with other brothers and sisters who eventually joined the Black Panther Party after it was formed in the year 1966 in October. And he used to ride through the streets with the same equipment that the fascist pigs in the streets had themselves, with a shotgun, and stood up for just a moment to say that our people would no longer tolerate being dehumanized, that we would grab our freedom. And if it would take his very life to make that example for all of us, then that was nothing, because he would give his life gladly over and over again. And in October of 1967, the very same Oakland Police Department specifically, working in combination with all of the fascist forces around the country and with all of the various intercommunal forces around the world, attempted to take the life of this man. But they were not successful. The only thing they were able to do was to put him in their maximum security cell, because we say we're already at minimum security at this time, because we're on the streets and we're not free. There's no point in thinking that there's too much difference between being in a jail cell in a specific city in a specific county than being on the streets of a specific city or a specific county, because you're still in jail. And so they put him into their maximum security cell and held him there until the people's cry was so loud for his freedom that they had no choice but to release him back to the people. And I don't think that anyone around the world can forget the example that was set that day and since that time. And the members of the Black Panther Party have been following the example and the ideology and the thoughts of this man since that time, and attempting to put into practice and attempting to make as many examples as possible so that all of the people will eventually ride through the streets and take their freedom with whatever means necessary, as Malcolm X used to say. And so what they have done in the past several years since this party was begun and organized by this man, they have killed many of our brothers and sisters. They have incarcerated hundreds. They have attacked our offices. They have attacked everyone, people that we know. They have done everything they can to destroy the Black Panther Party, because it wasn't any one person. They thought they could destroy one person and destroy the whole party, but they were not able to do that. And so tonight, we want to bring you, for the first time since we began to celebrate the birthday of this man, a man who in October 1966 rose to the streets and declared that he was a man and that he was a revolutionary, the Minister of Defense of the Black Panther Party and the supreme servant of the people, Eugene Nunes!
I'm not here because of the Black Panther Party. I'm not here because of any group. I'm not here because of a group of kamikazes. I'm here because of the power of the people. We must remember that revolution is a process. It's not a conclusion, because once we conclude, then we become counter-revolutionary. And that means even if we conclude with a gun in our hands, because fascism also has a gun. So I would like to say tonight that the Black Panther Party stands against all forms of fascism, including sexual fascism, that we are against all kinds of chauvinism, including racial chauvinism. We're against sexual chauvinism, national chauvinism. We're intercommunalists. That before I went to prison, most of you know, you're aware that I never made any speeches, you see, because I'm not a very eloquent man. I'm better known by the actions. And the party was built upon the actions. And the action itself is a process. And we're not ever fixated. We haven't accepted any dogma, and we will not. But I would like to say this, that from now on, that the party itself will be better known by its contributions to the people for the simple reason that some people around us seem to want to be known through the media. But the party can only judge itself through establishing certain survival programs pending revolution, because remember, you make the revolution. We can't free political prisoners. Only the people can free political prisoners. And a people who are not free cannot free their prisoners, cannot free the prisoners that fascism make. So I would like to say that we must work very hard in order to lift the consciousness of the people. We must free our chairman, Bobby Seale, Angela Davis, Rochelle McGee, the Soledad brothers, the seven and the three, and all other political prisoners. Randy, we have to free all of them. But we must remember that we must exhaust every possible tactic. And we must let it be known that never broadcast military tactics for military reasons. It's perfectly correct to broadcast military tactics for political reasons. That's what Uncle Ho said, and I agree with him. So we would like for the people to know that there are many things that we will not discuss in public. But what you can do is watch the fruits of GAN. And we would like to say that our party became an intercommunal party upon its actions. And I think that's very good. So I'm asking you, in order to free all political prisoners, free the people, free the woman, and also the man, that we have to get together in unity. And we cannot get together in unity by substituting verbal expressions for action. The final test of the pie is in the action. We'll stand on the Black Panther Party. The Black Panther Party from 1966, when it was formed, will stand on its record. We'll stand on the action. We won't claim to be ultra-leftists. We won't claim to be infantile leftists. What we'll do is act in accordance to the particular set of conditions and the particular problem that we have at a time. So please judge us upon our actions, and we will develop like that. We will not... We will not develop with lip service coming from anyone. And sometimes I'm very thankful that I don't talk too well, because that's only one way of communication. We say that a picture's worth a thousand words, but action is supreme. And but what kind of action that you take will depend upon the particular set of conditions. And I say all of this because, you know, the party and the world today is under turmoil, and this is very good. We always have welcomed all forms of contradictions, because without the contradiction, there's no transformation. So from the contradiction that's developed now in the world and in the party, we hope to have a qualitative leap. And if this leap eliminates some of us, then of course we'll weep for that. But we must not stop the revolution. I will not stop the revolution. You should not stop it. And for all that is worth, that we know that words will never stop it. Words will not stop the revolution either, only action. 66 kicked off the armed manifestation of revolution in this country, because it focused upon the need for the people not only to defend themselves, but also to develop a consciousness necessary to perform and to act, to be able to fight in a protective war, you see? And that is why that it's necessary for us to develop the correct ideology, which is a system of thinking. And we must not rely and conclude with the philosophy, which is necessarily a conclusion. So we are ideologically revolutionists. We're in a constant state of change, and we fight with all people who want to change, because we know change will offer our hope. So after all of this, that we must pay more attention to what has happened. The news media has attempted to discredit the party by saying that it's over because they don't see anyone. I think our programs are better than the party. The communities are involved in 44 cities. We must support these. We must expand them because I read an article recently, a few months ago, where Che had some problems in Bolivia because the peasants were so unconscious until he could not rally them even with the focals. They did not understand why the military, regular military, was dropping. So what did he do? He attempted to form a certain programs that he called survival programs. He attempted to form a free health program in order to get the peasants inside to help them and also to provide things for his focals. He also attempted to form free breakfast program and also a free shoe factory and a sporting goods store for obvious reasons. So program is good because an act that might be revolutionary could be counter-revolutionary if the correct preparations are not made. So to be a serious revolutionist, we must know that we're involved in a process and not a set of principles or conclusions that are on face value revolutionary. I do not know one thing that is revolutionary in itself, and all things might be revolutionary in its context. In other words, feudalism was revolutionary when it kicked out capitalism, and then when the feudalists were kicked out by the capitalists, that was also revolutionary. And now we have a situation where the capitalists have become the imperialists, and the people of the world or the communities of the world will have to kick him out. So in order to free Angela Bobby, Rochelle McGee, and all other political prisoners, we must kick the fascists out, and we cannot do it with lip service. Power to the people.
Welcome back, and that was Huey P. Newton speaking in that last audio file, speaking at the Intercommunal Solidarity Day on March 5th of 1971 in Oakland, California. And now we're going to listen to some excerpts from various developments in 1971. This is the statement of the Black Panther Party on the murder of George Jackson. This statement was released on August 22nd of 1971.
Here is the statement concerning Brother George Jackson, concerning the situation at San Quentin Prison. What happened yesterday? From the Intercommunal News Service of the Black Panther Party, the servant of the people, Huey P. Newton, states that our position is in support of the action of George Jackson. The first rule when a people's soldier is captured is to immediately start planning his escape. His action was a political statement because he set the standard for all political prisoners. He took the only available avenue of redress against state murder. The state created the violent situation that exists in San Quentin today. The state gives itself the arbitrary privilege of taking life, the right to kill, capital punishment, sanctioned violence, which leaves no room for redress. redress of grievance is the contract between the people and the state in relationship to the laws of the land. People will respect laws that serve them and will tolerate those that they do not respect, as long as there is an avenue for redress and change. Voting and petitioning and other actions are redress vehicles. But when capital punishment is legislated, the neutral relationship regarding life between the people and the state breaks down. The person being threatened with death by the state has no alternatives but to defend itself. All living things have an inalienable right to protect their own lives. Their own lives, all inalienable rights must be protected. But to continue correctly with the servant's statement, we state this, the minister, the servant has stated this. If the state decides it can take life, then the people can defend life. The basic integrity of man is predicated upon respect for life. The state does not have the right to take life. Every man has a right to preserve his own life. The state is supposed to represent the basic integrity of the individual. We should all hold life sacred. No one, including the state, should have the right to snuff out life. No one, including the state, should have the right to snuff out life. Only through natural forces and acts of God should man give life up. And science, through its research and production of medicines, is trying to combat the thing we call death. There is no capital punishment. Or might I say, if there is no capital punishment, to be correct, on the intercommunal level, this would stop all wars of aggression. If there is no capital punishment on the intercommunal level, this would stop all wars of aggression, because the only time one could take life is in the defense of life, never in a retaliatory posture, that is, against individuals. But to continue with the servant's statement and to sum it up, George Jackson, Field Marshal for the Black Panther Party. Let me repeat, George Jackson, Field Marshal for the Black Panther Party. A soldier in the People's Army, gave his life in an attempt to free political prisoners and to preserve his own dignity and manhood. Field Marshal George Jackson moved in a defensive manner. The state had threatened to take Brother George's life. The executioner already had a hood over his head. A glass cage had been built and euphemistically called a courtroom. The shackles were locked. George broke the shackles, spurned the glass cage, and defended his manhood in the spirit of freedom. Brothers and sisters, people, everyone, community, black community. Everyone interconnected, interlocked, interrelated, from the black community to everywhere in the world. The minister said this in his last paragraph, and I read, George Jackson was a supreme servant of the people because he gave his life, all that any human being can give when struggling for all oppressed people. Now, this statement was signed by Huey P. Newton, servant of the people from the Black Panther Party.
That was Bobby Seale reading a statement from Huey P. Newton on the assassination of George Jackson, which took place on August 21st of 1971 at San Quentin Prison in the state of California. We're commemorating Black August, and we'll take a break. We'll be back with more of our program for this week. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, a special worldwide radio broadcast. I am your host, Abayomi Azikwe, and we're here on a weekly basis. We'll be back. connection. I am the black gold of the sun. And we're going to go back to look at developments in 1970-1971. Let's listen in.
Units that was on the street and advised him again to relay via radio to the office just precisely what we had and advising him again to close off the area. I took a shotgun then and I came up through here and I got over this railing here and assuming this was one of the exits that they would use, and I was here maybe 3 or 4 minutes and the whole group of hostages and suspects with the exception of one went out through this door here. And
how many were there?
In the group, I would say there were 6 or 7, something of this nature.
What did they do then?
And I couldn't use the weapon because the judge and everybody was mixed up in the group. And as they got out here, then this other bushy-haired, light-haired one came out. He had the automatic weapon. It was a carbine AR-type weapon. And he came out, and about this time, the one that had the gun on Judge Haley turned around and saw me. And he says, kill that mother. He says, kill him, kill him, kill him. And he came out this door, and he put the gun right on me, and we were standing there facing each other. And he's still in line with this group.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I'm going to kill you. And so I dropped down behind here. And I had just had my head sticking over the top there. And he says, come out. He says, I'm going to kill you. And he says, I want the gun. He says, bring me the gun. So I came over the rail, and I got up to him, and he said, lay it at my feet. And I laid the gun at his feet. And he said, now I'm going to kill you. And so I got my hands up, and I started to back away. And I got about here, and then something distracted them in this area over here. And the ones who were holding the hostages started yelling, but I couldn't make out really what it was. I was more interested in my position at the time. So this guy momentarily turned back to this other group that was to his left, and I started backing up with my hands up, and I got down here where I could get in between these cars.
Complected Negro with bushy hair pointing a handgun at the back of the neck of Lieutenant Dixon of San Quentin Correctional Force. Everybody hit the floor except some of the lady jurors. This stranger came forward and passed the handgun to the defendant McLean, who put the gun on Judge Haley. The intervener withdrew from the bag, a large bag, an automatic rifle, covered all the correctional personnel, and at gunpoint they were forced to unshackle the witness McGee, who had been on the witness stand. McGee was then armed too, and I think it was McGee who was sent to the holding cell to liberate the three remaining witnesses who were under guard in the holding cell. During this time, Judge Haley called Sheriff Montanus by phone, and the defendant McLean was at his side while the telephone call was being made. The judge said, we have four dangerous men in the courtroom, fully armed, and they have the courtroom under subjection. We do not want any interference here at this time, and other that we do not jeopardize any lives.
There are still a great many loose ends and a great deal of speculation about what happened here. Investigators will now try to determine if there was a conspiracy of some kind that involved perhaps more persons than those who actually participated in the bloody event. Investigators say militant organizations such as the Black Panther Party will be high on the list of inquiry.
The suspect that was on the stand got up, walked over to one of the San Quentin guards, who by this time were all lying on the ground.
How many of the guards were there?
There were five.
Five guards in the room, yeah.
And told one of them to get up. I think the suspect's name was McKenna, or the one who was testifying was McKenna. He said, you've held me in San Quentin for X number of years. I was unjustly accused. Now for the love of God, take these cuffs off of me. I want to be a free man. There was discussion about taking the two older women, myself, and the baby that was in the courtroom.
Baby in the courtroom?
They abducted a young couple walking by outside with a small child, about 18 months old. And McLean kept saying, leave the bailiff alone. He's all right. Right. They started using piano wire on some of the people. I don't know how many. The judge told him everything would be all right. They called the sheriff, talked to the sheriff.
Who called the sheriff?
The judge called the sheriff, talked to the sheriff. Right. And McLean got on the got on the phone and told the sheriff to call all those dog pigs off, or they were going to kill everybody in the courtroom. They had an automatic weapon, and he just opened up, and he could listen to it.
For Jonathan to come to the point he reached last Friday.
He built over a period of time. He built up over a period of time. Seeing the process of Angelina Campbell in Brazil. Oh yeah, enough to share anybody's face.
At the sitting for, I guess, since February, watching Judge Campbell shake his head no and conspire with the prosecutor to send them to the gas chamber. How could anyone who's ever sat in that courtroom think that anybody would get justice? I don't see how anybody could expect it. Not if you're black and poor.
Do you think that's what Jonathan was thinking?
I think that's what he was thinking. I know he was very depressed about the way that the courts were. My son Jonathan had a lot of faith in the way the courts were until George came up to the court. We all had faith in the court. You know, there are many black people in this country who have faith in the court. They believe they can get justice. I used to believe it myself, but not anymore.
What happens to George now? What do you expect?
I don't know what will happen to George. I hope that people who think and people who try to realize what's been going on, and many people who have been going down to Salinas know what has been going on.
I tried to get out. I went to school, program, but now on the side, I was studying things that I felt it would help the community. My personal opinion of what the black community needs. Officials in the field, that the the things that I was doing, the things that I was saying, were the type of things they wanted in the street.
While I was gathered at the murder, the specific murder of James Jackson last week, and to discuss basically what is going on, organization, different points of view, so I would like to discuss these things with people here.
First of all, I'm going to explain to you your gun and scope on it. And then I'll step in personal time. Three black guys, and one black guy.
I think it can be said that the prisoners show definitely the following signs of some bodily injury. Contusions, some abrasions, some lacerations. There were those who suffered from one fracture of the fourth metacarpal bone of the right hand, and according to the warden's testimony, this fracture was acquired prior to the events of last Saturday. There were no signs of injuries that could be as recent as having occurred in the last 36 hours. This, I believe, is a objective statement of my findings as one interested in a medical statement of conditions as I observed at the institution.
I'm a lay person, I'm not a physician, but there were contusions, there were bruises. It was obvious that, that people had been struck. There was no question about that.
Rochelle McGee hurt?
Rochelle McGee is one of the people that also has bruises and contusions.
Approved today 43 new positions for San Quentin. And they're to be utilized at the discretion of the, in terms of new programming that'll go on here too. And I can't describe that to you other than it'll be evolved over a period of time with the input from the staff. To make this place safe, and the warden is free to use those 43 positions. And we did this through, and they came to me by virtue of the staff and the employees groups and the employees all along the line, suggesting that's the amount of staff under the new program it'll take to make this place safe.
Have there been any resignations?
Resignations on behalf of
I don't think there was a real threat. But we got some of the damnedest people you ever seen in your life working in corrections, and they got plenty of guts. So some of them resigning, I don't fault them for resigning. A lot of people were talking about it, and I don't blame them for talking about it. But in the final analysis, they're not going to abandon the ship when it's rocking a little bit.
It was a very quick trip, and we were permitted maybe 5 minutes in each wing. There are two wings inside with 17 cells in each of the two wings, and we were at liberty to walk up and down and talk to the prisoners, and they talked to us, but we were limited in the time we could spend. We could see all of the prisoners in their cells, those that were occupied. There were some indications, physical indications, of bruises. Impossible, of course, to tell how they got the bruises.
What did you learn that you didn't know when you walked in there?
Not a heck of a lot about the kind of treatment they're receiving.
Well, one thing that should be pointed out was that
they conducted it like
in depth and only respond if the prisoners are, asked us a question.
An interesting reaction on the part of one of the guards as we walked from the main visiting area.
I do not think that the adjustment centers are accomplishing their objectives. In fact, they're making hardened men who can possibly be rehabilitated. I think the adjustment center ought to be abolished.
Do you know that, or you held that opinion before today? What does this simply reinforce what you've already felt?
Absolutely. What I saw here is the same as what I saw at Soledad. As a matter of fact, I saw some of the same faces here that I saw in Soledad. The same men.
We are going to request that a joint committee
of inquiry be sent here from the legislature. We're going to ask the chairman of the Rules Committee on the Senate side, who will do that appointing, and the Speaker of the Assembly on our side, to appoint a joint committee to come here and investigate the incidents of August the 21st and thereafter. And I think the only thing we can expect to get out of that are the facts. Now, if the facts have to be on the side of the guard, so be it. If they're on the side of the inmates, so be it. But let's stop all the business of not finding out what the facts are and telling people you can't go in here, you can't go there, as if to hide something.
Yet a third group of persons toured San Quentin's Adjustment Center today. Several members of the Marin County Grand Jury went through the facility asking the same basic question. What happened here on the 21st day of August? Mike Mills reporting for Newswatch.
I'd see him go to work, and I'd see him come home, and I had no doubts or fears, as I don't think my children did either. And he'd come home, and he just wanted to relax, and really had no too many pressures, and just, I think, maybe the last couple of months when things got just a little bit tense. He would come home and say that so-and-so was contracted on. It was happened to be a very good friend of his.
That means that he's marked for death.
Right. And they were going to get him next. And then each time an officer got killed, and I think what really stirred it up was the last one was Leo Davis.
Yes.
And then I think the tenseness then got a little bit worse. Well, everybody gets their chance to speak, but with all this mail that I have received, numerous letters from all over the United States, I don't think there's one that hasn't missed, feel the same as I do, that there's not enough in the papers about people, say, like my husband or any other officer, but you pick up, it's either Angela Davis or Soledad Brothers or the Comrades or building these people up.
Mention letters you've received.
Very numerous. And they're beautiful letters. People who are concerned.
Can you tell me about some of them?
I have received two letters from prisoners who thought very highly of my husband. They could communicate with him and explain to the prisoner himself where they were wrong, how they could improve themselves. And they turned out to be very good friends. I also received a letter from a black man saying he was a little ashamed of his brethren. That he says, believe me, the majority of us aren't that way. And he says, I'm ashamed of what has happened.
Quentin Prison, California, 3 weeks after the bloodiest event in its history.
You can't explain it. You have tension, it's something you can feel. You can actually walk in here and feel it, if there's tension.
We have the Ku Klux Klan and the Black Panthers who would like to get at each other's throat and who use every opportunity to inflame racial tensions.
Well, we have different groups in the institutions such as Nazis, Black Panthers.
Nazis?
Nazis.
What are they?
Well, they're just a group of fellows. Now, I don't know. Some of them are pretty good people that I have to deal with. Now, whether you want to call them radicals or not, I don't know. But being a Nazi, I would say radical.
Maybe dividing racial groups, you know, the Mexicans be on one side, and all the brothers be on one side, all the whites be on another side, you know, and it's constant tension, you know, in this yard. It's constant tension in this institution. I imagine it's constant tension in every institution around the world, you know, but I believe more so here. Like I said before, I don't exactly know why, you know. It's like just the smallest incident, some of the, you know, the simplest thing can touch off a race riot or some kind of riot, you know. If a white sticks a brother, then it's automatic retaliation.
Violence is no stranger to prison life. Prisoners live on top of each other 24 hours a day. There's no ghetto or white suburb for them to go home to. The authorities accept this state of undeclared war. Some guards actively encourage it. If one inmate is attacking another, at least the guard isn't getting hurt. What was new and alarming was that inmates should suddenly turn their violence against their keepers.
Since March, we've been having problems racial-wise. It was blacks against whites and vice versa. Now it's almost seems like everybody's against what they call the greenies, which means the officers in green uniforms. So we're always looking out behind our back all the time.
Tension had been mounting here at San Quentin Prison for several months. With encouragement from black militants and radical lawyers outside, more and more black inmates were becoming politicized and organized inside the prison walls. These activities culminated in an event which, in the long term, may be judged more important than Attica, simply because of the death of one man. Here, on Saturday, August the 21st, three white guards and two white trustee prisoners were murdered, and one black prisoner, George Jackson, was shot in circumstances which are, to say the least, mysterious.
I love him like a brother, you know, and I respect him for what he, you know, what he believed in. That was a change, you know. I believe it. I definitely believe in a change. There's got to be a change.
Well, George Jackson was a smart man as far as being smart, but he was a belligerent radical. As far as I'm concerned, I've had dealings with the man. And if he was, I feel this way, if he was trying to help his people, or the, let me try and think of how to put this. If he was trying to help his people, the people that, the black people that are straight people and are never looking for trouble outside of their radicals. George Jackson was a radical, period. This is my estimation of the man, although he was smart. But George Jackson, like I say, I've had dealings with him, and I wouldn't give you 2 cents for a carload like him.
Life was poor. We were very poor. We lived in cold water flats. But it was nice. It looked like a little dollhouse on the inside.
How was that?
Because I painted it and fixed it up nice, kept it clean. And everybody was always surprised when they came in our flat by the way it looked, you know, the outside and where it was without the way it looked inside.
When you say you were poor, how poor were you?
Very poor. We used to live, back in the 40s. My husband would make probably $19 or $20 a week. We would usually always buy baby food first. And if there's anything left, we'd buy something for ourselves. If it wasn't, we wouldn't. That's how poor we were.
Did George ever talk to you about the fact that he was black and you were black and that you were a poor family? Did he ever discuss that with you?
I used to talk to them about it. I used to tell them that they were black. And in order to achieve, they'd have to be twice as good as white. I said, if you're twice as good as the white in school, then maybe you'll make something. Yes, that's what I used to tell them. It was the truth. So why hide it from them?
Jackson's political education was aided by one of those strange liberal quirks in California law, which allows a prisoner mental, if not physical, freedom. Any book, revolutionary or otherwise, that the prisoner requires, the prison authorities are bound to let him have.
Isn't one of the ironies that you can lock someone up for a long period of time and yet give him access to any revolutionary material he requires? Thereby, don't you create a revolutionary?
If we put a man in a cell, and by his nature of his acting out, we are required to keep him in his cell, then we feed him all the revolutionary works, and George Jackson had, I guess, 100 or more revolutionary works. Of course, it gives him nothing else to think about. He's not concerned about bettering himself. He's only looking forward to the day when he can get out and become a true revolutionary.
You guys want to step on this chair?
Not only do prisoners have time to read and study revolution, they also have time to organize and fashion the instruments of guerrilla warfare, the bomb, the knife, and the gun. San Quentin has its own counter-insurgency troops.
Strip. Take your pants off. See your shoes?
These are the kind of weapons they're looking for. Zip guns, knuckle dusters, knives and hatchets. They may be crude, but they kill. For the past year, under the tightest and most sophisticated security conditions in America, Angela Davis has been held in the Marin County Jail, waiting for her trial proper to begin. She had not been allowed to give any television interviews. Our attempts to film an interview with Angela Davis are perhaps the best possible indication of the kind of fear and tension that surrounds her. After prolonged haggling, permission was granted for the interview to be shot through a soundproof, bulletproof screen. I was to be on one side, and Angela Davis was to be on the other. Our only means of communication was to be via the telephone. At last, the authorities gave way and allowed me behind the screen, but the film crew had to stay on the other side.
Angela, some of the letters that George wrote you are not revolutionary tracts, but they're love letters in almost the romantic sense. How close were you to George?
Well, we were very close, both as revolutionary comrades and also in a personal sense.
How in a personal sense? How did you get to know each other?
The first time I met him was on the occasion of one of the court appearances in Salinas, California. I had not really expected the scene that confronted me when I walked into that courtroom and sat down and saw coming into the courtroom three black men who were chained and shackled. I had never seen black men before with chains all over their bodies. It was certainly reminiscent of slavery. And in spite of the fact that they were completely suppressed in a physical sense, you could see from the attitude and their demeanor when they entered the courtroom that they were not for a moment going to resign themselves to that situation, that they were that they had a very profound fighting spirit, and it was that which really affected me very strongly.
Can you understand what life was like for George Jackson in prison, now that you yourself have spent almost a year in prison yourself?
It's very difficult to understand, I think, for anyone who hasn't experienced what George experienced personally. I know that, you know, although I am in jail myself, certainly it is not identical to the type of experience that George had 7 years in solitary confinement. For a long time, did not have access to the kinds of books that he wanted to continue his development. He did not have access to people on the outside, because the only individuals permitted to visit him were his family. And then also the fact that precisely because George refused to be the type of person that the prison system is designed to create. He experienced a surplus repression. He experienced a repression that was much, much more intense than anything I think I have individually gone through.
Three weeks ago, on August the 21st, at San Quentin Prison, George Jackson was killed, 2 days before his trial was finally due to begin. This is what the prison authorities say happened on that day. Stephen Bingham, a radical young attorney, came to visit Jackson and passed through a metal detector like this, which bleeped. His briefcase was searched and found to contain a tape recorder. Hidden inside it, say the authorities, was a gun like this. Bingham was also alleged to have smuggled in an Afro wig under which Jackson was to hide the gun to get it back to his cell. Jackson then walked through this door, so the authorities say, across the front courtyard of the prison and back to his cell in this block. Exactly what happened inside that block in the next 20 minutes, only a few people know, and most of them are dead. What we do know is that 25 prisoners were released. Then three white guards and two white inmates were killed. Two of them had bullet wounds. All of them had their throats cut, with a razor blade embedded in a toothbrush. The alarm was sounded. Jackson ran out of the block and back across the courtyard, gun in hand. The authorities say he was shot twice, in the legs and through the head. He fell here and died, making for this wall 50 yards away and 25 feet high. That's the official version of Jackson's death. It raises several questions. Who killed George Jackson?
I don't know. I don't know by name, and I wouldn't tell you if I did, because this would be a matter, again, that goes before the courts. But he was killed by rifle fire from one of our armed posts, and if I were to anticipate your next question as to why was he killed, any man with a pistol in his hand running for the wall at this institution, if he was not shot at and either harmed or killed, the officer in the tower would be not doing his duty. That's exactly what he is there for.
I raise my children to love people. I raise them to mingle in American society, but American society didn't want them.
Do you think that George's death was inevitable, given the kind of things he was saying and writing?
They couldn't let him live. Wouldn't be any way possible for them to let him live. He's a black man. They're afraid that people will begin to listen. And they had. People all over the world had begun to listen to George. And I certainly know the people in this country had. That's the reason why they framed him to be murdered the way he was, to try to discredit everything that he had said, to try to paint him as an insane maniac, an animal. That was the reason for it.
What were Jackson's aims?
Well, I think Jackson's aims have been clearly stated. He wants to become part of the revolution that overthrows society as is today constituted, the establishment in this country, and of course as part of a worldwide movement. I don't think any question that he was dedicated to violence. His writings clearly state that he's dedicated to violence, that he didn't intend to ever get paroled from the California prison system. He intended to escape from the California prison system.
Was he violent? Could he be violent?
Only if people were violent to him. I can be violent also, and I imagine so can you. You see, that's the whole story of America. They take their violence and turn it back around on somebody else. I don't have to talk about American violence. You can look all over the world and see American soldiers everywhere fighting in other people's countries and killing them. So if I were running the country in America, I wouldn't open my mouth about violence. As many people as they've murdered in Vietnam in the past 10 years, and they're going to talk about violence? As many black people that get killed every day in this country and nobody knows or cares, and they're going to tell me about violence? how they wiped out a whole nation of Indians, and they're going to say something to me about violence. I don't want to hear it.
I'm a black woman committed to struggle for the liberation of my people, and George Jackson is a black man committed and committed to the struggle for the liberation of his people also.
Do revolutionaries like yourself and George Jackson have to die?
I mean, this is something that we realize as black people. It might possibly happen to any one of us, and especially if we have made it clear that we are going to continue to struggle no matter what the circumstances are. George certainly is a symbol, but he made very, very profound and very, very concrete contributions to the black liberation struggle in this country. Thousands, millions, perhaps, of people who have read his book have seen articulated in this book the frustrations and the desire that black people have had for hundreds of years in this country. So in that sense, he is not just a martyr.
George says to us, "Arise and walk. Silver and gold have I none, but in the name of God I give you what I have. In the name of Jesus of Nazareth, I say, rise up and walk. In the name of Denmark Vesey of Charleston, South Carolina, I say, rise up and walk. In the name of the Reverend Nat Turner of Southampton County, Virginia, I say, rise up and walk. In the name of Frederick Douglass, in the name of W.B. Du Bois, I say, rise up and walk. In the name of my brother, Jonathan Jackson, in the name of James McLean, in the name of William Christmas, in the name of Angela Davis, and in the name of George Jackson, I say, rise up and walk."
Good evening. I'm Belva Davis. Welcome to the world premiere of Day of the Gun. As a television journalist reporting on the explosive events of the 1970s, I saw firsthand the fierce and prolonged struggle which engulfed America and the Bay Area. I covered the free speech movement in Berkeley, the emergence of the Black Panther Party, the anger, protest, and riots of the anti-war movement. Those were dangerous and fearful times. One of the most brutal moments occurred at San Quentin Prison in August of 1971 when inmate, revolutionary George Jackson obtained a gun behind prison walls. The consequences were deadly. To this day, it remains a story filled with mystery and suspicion. Because tonight's special contains graphic pictures and descriptions of violent events, viewer discretion is advised. Now, Cron 4 presents Day of the Gun.
In spite of all, I am human and have done things that require forgiveness from others. I have transgressed against my fellows in moments of weakness and madness. I hope I can make it. George Jackson.
In the fall of 1970, George Jackson skyrocketed to international fame with the publication of his book, Soledad Brother, The Prison Letters of George Jackson. By the next year, he was dead.
George Jackson served a life sentence, which turned out to be a death sentence, for a $70 robbery.
The story of George Jackson is a story of the dark side of America. In August of 1971, when Jackson was a 29-year-old inmate at California's San Quentin Prison, he became the central figure in the prison's bloodiest day. Jackson obtained a gun, and in less than 30 minutes, a murderous rampage turned the Adjustment Center into a slaughterhouse. Six men, including Jackson, were killed.
It was unprecedented. It had never, ever happened before. It's never happened again.
During his prison life, George Jackson was a polarizing figure, hated as much as he was loved.
He was a threat in the prison system. He was one that just didn't seem to be very afraid.
He was defiant, he was proud, he was a revolutionary.
George Jackson was a thug. My guess is that he stole lunch money from his grade school associates.
He educated himself and emerged as the most powerful intellectual within the prison system.
He was a punk convict until he was catapulted into the spotlight. Once in the limelight, I think he rose above punk convict, but I think he never rose above opportunist.
In the end, when George Jackson's cause had been lost and the cult of hero worship contaminated his heart and soul, Jackson sought comfort in a few loyal friends, Marx, Lenin, and Ho Chi Minh, the Vietnamese revolutionary who predicted, "When the prison gates fly open, the dragons will emerge." On a hot August day, with gun in hand, Jackson would tell the world just that. Ascendancy of George Jackson came at a time when America's soul and its people were coming apart.
That this is revolution.
We will not be fooled.
The turbulent decades of the 1960s and 70s merged as one. The country's democratic institutions were severely challenged. Some advocated revolution.
I'm going to start right now to inform white people of what they don't know.
The black people in this country have been the victims of violence at the hands of the white man for 400 years.
I think it's un-American.
We cannot survive if we go fight some yellow man in Vietnam who ain't never called us nigger.
People had marched, people had gone to jail, people were very frustrated and very angry.
The unpopular war in Vietnam had become the longest and most divisive in American history. The bitter struggle for civil rights confirmed the failed promise of equality for all.
We'd been confined to the ghetto for years and years and years. We'd not been allowed to break out of the ghetto.
Riots turned American cities into burning embers. The political assassinations of Malcolm X, Martin Luther King Jr., and Robert Kennedy deepened the country's paranoia.
We were being put in a position of having to feel that our lives were under the gun.
Huey P. Newton and the Black Panther Party wanted justice beyond the streets of Oakland.
There were, I suppose, those who felt that all one needed to do was to take up the gun, and that that would be the path toward freedom.
The prisons of California had become a target for revolutionary change as well. The New Left viewed the growing convict population as symptomatic of the country's deeper social ills.
We've got the militant blacks, the militant Nazis, the militant Chicanos. They're all here under one roof, and we are sitting on this lid like a tea kettle waiting for the steam to either come up or the lid to blow off.
Inmates were championed as political prisoners, vanguards of the coming revolution.
victims of their fascist capitalist oppressors.
As long as there is any political prisoner in this country, as long as anyone is being discriminated against, none of us are free.
When George Jackson emerged as the new god and leader of the left, those on the right saw him as the most powerful threat in the prison system.
I think racism is a control device, control mechanism. Create an atmosphere whereby they can control inmates. And black is just a continuation of the same thing we've been going through on the street.
George Jackson was born in Chicago in 1941, one of five children in a poor working class family. His mother, Georgia, was afraid of what the streets could do to him.
She wouldn't let him go out and play. She kept him on the roof. You know, she wouldn't let him go out because she didn't want him to get in trouble.
I used to tell them that they were black, and in order to achieve, they'd have to be twice as good as white. I said, if you're twice as good as a white in school, then maybe you'll make something. Yes, that's what I used to tell them. It was the truth. So why hide it from them?
As a young boy at Catholic school, Jackson experienced racism. The playground was for white kids only. Growing up in the projects, he became involved in petty crime, fighting, stealing.
At age 15, his parents moved to L.A. and they settled in the Watts District, where he began to be involved in a little bit more serious crime, stealing a motorbike, breaking and entering. In 1958, he was convicted of a store burglary and sent to CYA, California Youth Authority camp, for several months. He escaped, fled back to Chicago, was involved in a knifing, came back to California in chains.
After spending time locked up in the California Youth Authority, Jackson graduated to state prison when he pled guilty to the robbery of a Bakersfield gas station. It was 1961. Jackson was 19 years old, and he received the indeterminate sentence of 1 year to life.
Well, I was incarcerated under a one to life, a term they call for one to life, where I could have done 1 year and been released. I've done 10. That's more time than anybody in the state has ever done on a one to life.
According to fellow inmate James Carr, when the two became leaders of a gang known as the Wolfpack, much of their time was spent in the usual convict hustles: gambling, booze, sex, blackmail.
He knew how to play the game. He was a tough guy. He studied martial arts. He was, you know, strong, very muscular, very smart, very cunning guy.
Good behavior dictated Jackson's chance for parole. It became non-existent. Prison records indicate that he received over 40 disciplinary actions. Jackson spent 7 years in solitary.
He was a big guy. He was a tough guy. He was a predator when he was in the general population. He was a predator of other inmates. He just abused people.
He became a professional prisoner, a real dyed-in-the-wool convict.
And then he started reading revolutionary theory. Then he started reading Marx and Lenin and Mao, and he wrote, I read Marx and Lenin and Mao, and they redeemed me. All of a sudden, he had a context for his anger. He realized, you know, why he was there, why people of his race, of his working class background, why they were in prison in disproportionate numbers. And that was the appeal of George Jackson. He represented in the highest way, the injustice of the system and the cruelty and the institutionalized racism of the system.
Coming up on Day of the Gun, inmate killings at Soledad Prison begins a chain of revenge and murder.
We now return to Cron4 Presents Day of the Gun. This program contains graphic pictures and descriptions of violent events. Viewer discretion is advised.
We die too easily.
We forgive and forget too easily. Gentle and refined people, aren't we? We'll make good communists if someone deals with the fascists for us.
In January of 1970, George Jackson was one of more than 2,000 inmates at Soledad Prison. Jackson had been here before. Located 100 miles south of San Francisco, the prison was in the heart of the fertile Salinas Valley, the salad bowl of America, the place where famed author John Steinbeck wrote eloquently of the dispossessed. When Soledad opened in 1951, it was the model for the California prison system, a showplace for reform. By the next decade, that hope had vanished.
Well, it was gladiator school. Of course, you had your gangs, you had your AB, Aryan Brotherhood, had your black, your BGF, your black guerrilla families, had the Mexican Mafia.
Soledad was a racist pit. It was a horrible, horrible place. I mean, the guards set the prisoners against each other. You know, there were conspiracies everywhere. There were stabbings. There were murders.
The guards were the enemy, the number one enemy, because they were killing both of us. And George was trying to explain this to a lot of guys. They couldn't get it to their heads.
Alan Mancino has spent much of his life behind bars, beginning as a teenager in the California Youth Authority. Like George Jackson, Mancino was from Los Angeles. Though the barrier of race allowed him to know Jackson only by reputation, the circumstance of their prison lives would crisscross in moments brutal and vicious, from Soledad to the tragedy at San Quentin.
The administration had him down as a troublemaker, as a instigator and agitator. He wasn't. He wasn't into the racial stuff, I'll say that about it.
I went through all the processes. I tried to get out. I went to school, program, but now on the side, I was studying. I think that I felt it would help the community.
George Jackson was a prisonized, tough, sometimes brutal prison gangster. And this prisonized toughness made him the best proselytizer for revolution on the yard.
At Soledad, the charismatic Jackson conducted secret political study groups with other inmates, trying to unify the prisoner class.
He was an intern.
Welcome back. And that was Reflections on the Lifetimes and Contributions of George Jackson. And we've been commemorating Black August here at the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast. We've been broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit on this Thursday, August the 29th, 2024. If you'd like to have access to this program, just go to our website at the Pan-African Radio Network. You can reach the Pan-African Radio Network by logging on to blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. If you'd like to read the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. We'll close out with Detroit's own Donald Byrd from his earliest recordings in 1955 from the album entitled Byrd's Word. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful week.